No dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, beardos? Welcome to episode 99 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will talk about what we've been eating, do some follow-up, discuss the news, and then ask the question, does having tattoos make you a bad animal rights advocate? Andy, I think we're going to have a hard time following up last week's episode, but we're going to do our darndest.
We certainly will. Before we even talk about last week's episode, Paul, though, I just want to remind everyone that we're coming up on episode 100, next episode, and that means it's a mailbag episode, and you already know, sending your emails, but just wanted to remind people that it's also the time when we announce the winners of our little contest that we have had going for the last three or four mailbags. And what can you win, you might be asking? You can win a Beard Vegans button and our brand new stickers. We posted a picture of those on the Instagram a little while back, so you can go check it out there. And all you have to do to enter is just go ahead and leave us an iTunes review. Any amount of stars, though we greatly appreciate the five-star reviews. And if you have already left us a review, thank you very much. You are already entered, so no need to worry about that. A few people seemed sad that they had already left reviews recently. So not to worry. You're entered for life. And the only thing that can take you out of it is if you've won once already. So yeah, thank you to everyone that does that. And it does mean the world to us when people leave those reviews. Helps us get a little more visibility. So if you're listening and you like what we have to say, you like our perspective on veganism, definitely go ahead and leave one of those reviews.
Cool. So yeah, last week's episode was our second live episode. It was absolutely incredible. It was a dream. We were both, I would say, I can speak for you, Andy, when I say we were nervous beyond belief right before we went out. Yeah.
Yeah. A healthy dose of, oh my God, this is happening and we better not mess it up.
Luckily, I mean, you could probably get this from listening to it, but luckily, Carol Adams is a seasoned pro at these sorts of events. So at least there was one person on the stage that was cool and collected.
Yes. Yeah. And it was just such an awesome time, such a cool experience, and definitely had me reflecting on, you know, the podcast and the opportunities that we've had because of it that mm-hmm. I certainly didn't really think would happen when we first started recording in your house, you know, 2 years ago.
Yeah. But,
you know, I guess we can reflect on that a little bit more on next episode, number 100. But it was awesome. The theater was, I want to say sold out, but we can only say at capacity because it's a free event. So I feel like that doesn't technically count as sold out. But apologies to those who came by and said that they couldn't get into the theater. Paul and I were just like, you know, when we saw the location, we're like, oh, no, this is going to be so awkward and no one shows up. And then a whole lot of people showed up. So yeah. Thank you for filling up that for us, a very large room.
Yeah, and thanks, of course, again to Carol Adams, who is absolutely amazing, and thanks also to Kevin, who helped put this on, who I actually just finished getting breakfast with earlier today.
Well, that is awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were in Toronto, and we talked a little bit in that episode, the live episode, about what we were eating, but we thought we'd just list a couple more of the things that we got in Toronto, which was, again, great, because it was all basically new restaurants.
It was great to get so many emails from beardos telling us where to eat, or, you know, I'd post one thing and they'd be like, you're so close to this place, head over here and get this menu item. And that was really cool. It was a fun experience. And yeah, on Sunday we did get to bop around a little bit more at the fest and try some more of the food. Something that I had my eye on, Paul, was this polenta poutine from Doug McNish, and we were all excited to go there on Sunday, and we showed up and they were not selling it on Sunday.
No delish from Doug McNish.
Delish McNish. but Paul,
yes,
they had a menu item that I know is something that you're always gravitating towards.
Mm-hmm. They had wings, and there was two flavors, buffalo wings and honey garlic wings, and I tore myself away from the buffalo, even though that was my inclination, because I was like, I think Andy would prefer the honey garlic wings. So I went with that, and I am not disappointed that I went with those, because they were so good, so crispy, so sweet, so good.
And before anyone reports us to the vegan police, it was in fact vegan honey.
Yeah, which don't know why they didn't put like a little asterisk or a little note about that, because I am sure that literally every single person that ordered that asked them, myself included.
Yeah, yeah. They're just putting themselves through a world of hurt by not or spelling it like H-U-N-N-Y or like H-O-N-E-E or putting honey in quotation marks.
Yeah.
It's just a whole lot of extra work for the poor counter person, I'm sure. But definitely Delish McNish for sure.
Delish McNish.
Delish McNish. I think that he should legally change his name to Delish.
It's so close already. He's already got the initials.
Yeah. D. Like if you just put D McNish on there, people could deduce that his name was Delish.
Something we also got to try was a Burger Cult, which I'm fairly certain, at least at the time that we got it, didn't have a physical restaurant, but it's kind of associated with the owner of Apocalypse Now. And there were some pretty extravagant burgers that they were selling.
Yeah, you know, Apocalypse Now, we haven't talked about them on the show, I guess, but they were one of the places that I was really looking forward to trying because I'd been following them on the internet for a while, and everyone, like, raves about them, and they just put out so much stuff, and then learned that they were doing this, like, Burger Cult, which is, like, their new project. And yeah, they're just starting out, only doing like pop-ups and like veg fests and things like that. And they have a whole thing on their website how that's just sort of how they do it. They grind it out and they build the following and then bring on the restaurant. And like they don't try and do it in the reverse order. So we were among the first, I guess, several thousand people to try them. This was their very first event. And Paul and I think, like, we both had our eye on one specific burger that had, like, mac and cheese and chips and, I think, fried pickles or something like that. But we got two burgers, and we ended up, I ended up loving this other burger we got way more than the first one.
Yeah, like, the second one, or, sorry, the first one, rather, the mac and cheese burger, barbecued mac and cheese burger, definitely was more visually like pleasing. Like I looked at that and I was like, this is a good burger. And the other one, which was kind of like a crunchy southern fried tofu burger in between two waffles, like it was a little more minimal looking, so we were kind of like, this one's gonna be good too, we'll get that one. And I think the chicken and waffle one ended up being so good, and the buffalo mac and cheeseburger, it was good, but it the other one kind of blew me away.
Yeah, and all of the burgers are like plays on band names, and so this was the I Ate Thou, and it was gluten-free corn waffle like buns with a crunchy southern fried tofu patty in the middle, and also potato salad, buttermilk ranch, and coconut bacon. And it was supposed to come with like a corn succotash, but they were out of that. However, as you noted, Paul, you're like, I can't imagine more things being put on this. And actually, mm-hmm. The thing that kind of put it over the top for me was that potato salad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That potato salad was real good.
Yeah. So Burger Cult, keep your eye out for them. And then one last mention for Strong Hearts Cafe, because we stopped through on our drive back. And it was, Paul, it was your first time. What'd you think?
Definitely the star of the show, Andy, was these milkshakes that we got. I had like an orange pineapple milkshake, and it was so good.
Yeah. Owner Joel was there, who greeted us and hooked us up with these milkshakes. And I didn't get one last time. I don't know why, because they make it with Temptation, which is from the folks, Chicago Soy Dairy, that do Dandies. And they used to, that ice cream, I used to love it. It used to be available in pints. And then they just kind of stopped doing the retail stuff, and they only supply for food service. It's who Chicago Diner uses for their milkshakes. And so I feel like you're really missing out if you don't get one of their milkshakes. And I got one that was chocolate and espresso, and it was just a mind-blowingly good milkshake. It was a phenomenal mm-hmm. milkshake. And I also got this sweet, sassy, molassy sandwich, which was featured like a tofu patty that had some kind of smoky, sweet sauce all around it. And it also had like a chipotle aioli and some veggies on it. By far the best thing I've ever had there. It was phenomenal. I think that it's going to be hard to not get that every time I go there now.
Yeah. No, it was great. I'm bummed that it's so far away from me, but hopefully I'll find my way back there soon.
maybe if you go to visit Niagara Falls from the boring ass American side.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I hope everyone appreciated on our Instagram our nice Niagara Falls selfie picture.
Yes. Yeah, it was a nice way to for me, begin and end, and for you, end our trip in Canada down there at Niagara Falls. Beautiful.
So let's move on. We got a piece of follow-up, and then we got a few different news items. I know it's kind of been a couple weeks since we've looked at the news, so there's a few things going on, Andy. What's happening?
Yeah, it feels like it's been so long since we talked, because we just recorded that Carol Adams episode like right after the last episode we did. So we got a lot to catch up on. And the first one is that we talked about Tyson Foods attempting to bring in this $320 million chicken processing plant to Tonganoxie, Kansas. And this article is coming to us from kansascity.com. And it says, Tyson Foods puts Tonganoxie poultry plant plans on hold. Good Lord, alliteration. We'll explore other sites. So the article says, in a letter to the Leavenworth County community on Tuesday, Tyson Poultry President Doug Ramsey wrote, We'd still like to get to know each other. However, after Monday's reversal of support by the Leavenworth County commissioners, we will put our plans in your community on hold. We still have interest in Leavenworth County, but we will prioritize the other locations in Kansas and other states that have expressed support. As of Wednesday morning, more than a dozen communities in Kansas have contacted the state about having Tyson build the proposed $320 million plant in their area, said Jackie McClaskey, great name, Kansas Secretary of Agriculture. So, yeah, so at the time that we reported on this, it was still like, they were just having their town meetings, and there were a lot of residents that were very upset about this chicken plant getting put in. And it appears that what they did swayed public opinion enough that the commissioners pulled out, and they were successful in getting Tyson to withdraw or put it on, quote unquote, on hold. So I guess we'll see. But according to Jackie McClaskey here, there's like a lot of towns in the state that are just jumping at the chance to have this giant operation get put in.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say this article sounds like it was written by Droopy Dog. A lot of alliteration going on.
Tyson Poultry President Doug Ramsey wrote, we'd still like to get to know each other. However, after Monday's reversal of support by the Leavenworth County Commissioners, we will put our plans in your community on hold.
There we go.
Tyson Foods puts Tonganoxie Poultry Plant plans on hold.
So, like, I guess this is a good thing. I'm hoping that it's not just the type of thing where it's like they just keep getting pushed out until they find a community that either doesn't have the resources, the people don't have the time, or what, for one reason or another, can't put up the fight that this community was able to. I'm hoping that's not the issue, and I'm hoping maybe Tyson will just get the picture that it's like, oh, this just isn't going to work, and we just have to cancel this. I don't know if that's how it works. I don't know. I think that's very optimistic of me, but I guess, like you said, we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's too optimistic, Paul. I think if the money's there, they're going to find a place to build it. I think you definitely hit it right on the nose that it'll probably keep getting pushed around until they find a community that can't fight back. I did a little bit of research and found that Tonganoxie is 95.2% white. That's as of the census in 2010. So, you know, Kansas tends to be not exactly a wealthy state, but obviously, if you're 95.2% white, you're probably more likely to be a more privileged community, probably one that has more of an ability to take time off of work to go fight these things, and also just sort of has the visibility to be taken seriously by your representatives. So it's like, I just wonder, like, how many of these people that were opposed to it eat chicken regularly? And I know in the last time we talked about it, some of them were saying their objections were that they don't like these big industrial operations and they prefer to support the small farmers. But I'd wager the small farmers aren't feeding every member of this town, and probably a lot of people that are opposed to this operation. And it's just kind of like, are these people that are content to pay for Tyson to do these horrible things as long as it's not in their backyard?
Yeah.
It's not good. It's not good at all. So, you know, again, I think that this can be used as like a learning opportunity or a conversation starter to tell people, like, listen, these are operations no one wants where they live. And the only way they won't get put somewhere is if we stop supporting animal agriculture, period. Like, Tyson or not. It's not just Tyson. I know Tyson gets a lot of flack, and as we talked about last time we talked about it, they are, like, one of the biggest polluters, if not the biggest polluters, and as far as putting, like, gross tonnage into waterways and all that stuff, but it's all of them. It's all of these, you know, animal agriculture operations. Obviously, not good for the environment. Of course, not good for the animals, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this kind of comes on the heels of something that Veg News reported on. South Dakota residents shut down proposed mega dairy, and this happened just outside of Lake Hendricks, South Dakota, and kind of a similar story. The town was outraged by this giant mega dairy getting put in, did a little research, found out that is a town that is 93.2% white as of the 2010 census. So starting to see a trend here. We know that, like, often these larger operations are put into communities of color and areas that are disenfranchised, generally speaking. So we're starting to see a trend, and it's not good. Again, I think it just means we got to educate people more on why they need to go vegan.
Yeah, I agree, Andy.
All right, well, then let's move on into the news and some good news. What you got for us, Paul?
Yeah, a surprising amount of good news, I'd say, from this week. So this is coming to us from vegnews.com. Dutch meat giant switches focus to plant protein. Dutch company Zwanenburg, which owns popular Dutch meat-centric brands Kips and Zwan, announced this week that it would sell a portion of its meat brands to refocus 50% of the company on selling vegetarian products such as soups, sauces, and meatless snacks. Company director Aldo van der Laan stated, "As a food producer, we are looking to profit from this by buying specific companies or building more factories. Major international companies such as Nestle, Danone, and Tyson are adjusting to consumer demand for animal-free food by diversifying their portfolios by investing in or wholly acquiring plant-based brands."
Wow.
So, on one hand, I think we could say this is a good thing because it's great if, like, the meat companies themselves are switching over. I know it's like this always, I feel like, on the other hand, causes a lot of controversy because people are like, wait a second, Hellman's is now making vegan mayo. We shouldn't support that. Or like Tyson, what did Tyson, what did they get their hands on?
Bought 5% of Beyond Meat.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like this sort of thing where I feel like there's always some skepticism, and, you know, I mean, they're clearly doing this because they see potential gains in terms of how much money they could make, and I'm 99% sure it's not because they've had some big change of heart. But I guess, like, in the system that we are currently working in, I guess this is a good thing if a major meat company is switching to. And 50% is no small amount to 50% meatless products.
Yeah, I think, again, capitalism is a horrible monster that must be stopped. But this does show that sort of within that specific system, supply and demand can have an effect. And this isn't the only thing that's going to get us out of the mess that we're in. But in general, I think it shows I'm going to call it a positive upswing.
I think so.
It's not something that, you know, when I went vegan 10 years ago, I thought that I would see. Even though I'm, like, optimistic, I'm like, obviously everyone will be vegan in the future, 50 years in the future, whatever. But it's also kind of one of those things that you're like, I don't expect to see it in my lifetime. And here we see kind of companies starting to rapidly shift, especially with a lot of those ice cream companies introducing their vegan lines. But we're seeing companies realize that, you know, and this is cool, I think, because it's not just, oh, we're adding these products. It's like we're shifting 50% of the company over. So presumably that means that they are going to be raising and killing less animals for food.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, like you said, it's still a part of this capitalist system that needs some reworking, but within that system, I would say this is a positive change. And again, 50% is a heck of a lot. I think this, to me, like, for a company that they're saying, like, this is one of the largest companies, Dutch companies, like, I've never seen or heard of that much of a shift, like half of their products. So maybe a sign of good things to come.
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
So that's a positive little piece of information. And Paul, mm-hmm. we've talked about clean meat, lab-grown meat, cultured meat a lot on the show. And a little news item popped up in regards to that development.
Yeah, so I think there are maybe some parallels between these two stories. This one is coming to us from independent.co.uk. China signs $300 million deal to buy lab-grown meat from Israel in move welcomed by vegans. Reading a little from that, China has signed a $300 million deal to purchase meat grown in a laboratory in Israel in a deal that could open a lucrative floodgate for vegan food manufacturers into the world's most populous country. China is not generally regarded as a world leader in environmental issues, so its deal with three Israeli companies, Supermeat, Future Meat Technologies, and Meat the Future, good pun, has been welcomed by some groups as a sign that China is committed to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions. So like I was saying, I feel like there's some parallels where it's like you're getting shifts towards, if not complete veganism, shifts towards veganism from entities that you would not necessarily expect. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess I think it's good. I mean, when I think about our conversations on this clean meat, this lab-grown meat, I think ultimately our conclusions are, we think it's good. Even the ones that do have some animal in them, we were like, I guess, you know, this isn't the thing we're going to like go rah-rah for and like really promote. But we're like, I guess we're glad someone's doing it. And then, of course, we have the Hampton Creek version, which claims that there's going to be no animals used except for like plucking a single feather from a chicken, or it can even just be a feather that's fallen on the ground. And I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, it's hard for me to really see the negative in that. And assuming it's like that aspect of lab-grown meat, it seems like it's a good step in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so too. And again, $300 million, that's a lot of money to be putting into lab-grown meat.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot. So I guess good job. I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, it's all for environmental reasons. And that seems like the big push for a lot of these, you know, the clean meat people is talking about it from environmental. And yeah, even, you know, Hampton Creek with their Just Mayo talking about why it's better for the environment as well. So I think that it's cool to see people committing to that. And I guess it makes me go, okay, I guess the environmental argument is a really strong one and something that we should use. I know we're always talking about, should we just focus on animals? Should we talk about these other things as well? So, yeah, I guess this is good.
Yeah, I think it's a tool to help us get to that place eventually.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I guess even if it's just kind of the foot in the door of getting people to go, hey, this food's not so weird. I like the way it tastes. And then getting them on board with the animal ethics when they're less scared about, you know, losing all of the food that they love and are part of, you know, mm-hmm. their upbringing and their family gatherings and all that stuff. Just showing people, hey, doesn't have to be that different. You just got to buy a couple, you know, items that look the same but are from different sources and you're good to go. So I think that alone could be a really powerful piece of this transition, this societal shift that we're looking for.
Yeah. All right, so Andy, you found this next piece.
Yeah, and I guess some people are not too excited about this societal shift, Paul.
Uh-oh.
So this is coming from agriland.ie, which is Ireland. Veganism is a controlled malnutrition. So
that sounds like a the title of a anti-vegan tough guy hardcore band song.
Yeah, yeah. So... Not, I don't know if this is necessarily news per se, but it's just a little something I wanted to throw in there. A few people sent it our way and wanted to know what we think or how we'd respond, so we're gonna do that. So this article says, veganism has been described as, quote, controlled malnutrition by the president of the Irish Cattle and Sheep Farmers Association, Patrick Kent. I guess no surprise that the president of the Irish Cattle and Sheep Farmers Association is trying to take down veganism. Speaking to AgriLands, which is the website this is from, Claire McCormack, during a live stream of the National Plowing Championships, sounds riveting, Kent gave his views on whether veganism poses a threat to Irish farming. He said, I think we have a massive opportunity to address some of these issues. Veganism now is very, very financed, and it is kind of a cult movement. A tomato in the 1940s had apparently as much nutrition as 8 tomatoes today. So people are eating a lot more calories, but they're actually malnourished, Kent said. Paul.
Yes, Andy.
This seems outright laughable, but how would you respond if someone posted this on your wall?
I guess, I mean, first you could point out the fact that, like you already brought up, this person clearly is coming from a bias position. Like, of course, like you said, they're going to like talk bad about veganism. They know that veganism is a threat to their existence, their livelihood. So of course they're going to try to find something to go against it. But kind of beyond that, I mean, I feel like the argument that they're making is not like, if in fact what they're saying is true, the argument that they're making is not like, our crops are going, like, things are going horribly wrong for our crops, so we should not, like, so people should not have the lifestyle where they mostly eat those things. His argument should be, hey, things are going horribly wrong for our crops, so we should figure out how to fix that. Like, if what he's saying is true, it's like, that seems like an issue that should not just be like, well, like, oh, well, this is how things are, so you can't, like, eat just these things. It should be, we need to, like, figure out how to get these nutrients back in there, or what's taking them out.
Yeah, yeah, and I do not know enough about the depletion of nutrients in the soil and all those things to really speak authoritatively on these things, but it could also just be an argument for genetically modified foods if this is in fact the case. But I do think that Patrick Kent here is incredibly misinformed. I don't know how many people out there are aware of Dr. Furman, not really someone we cover on the show because he's very kind of health and weight loss oriented. But I've read a few of his books, and something that he talks about a lot is the ANDI score, the ANDI, which stands for Aggregate Nutrient Density Index, and essentially it takes 34 kind of nutrition markers, you know, all the things you see on the nutrition label on the back of food, plus a bunch more, and kind of calculates them all together into a nutrition per calorie basis, and then ranks them on a scale from 0 to 1,000. And so this is nutrient density. This is what Patrick Kent is talking about, like, tomatoes aren't as good as they used to be, and therefore people have to eat 8 tomatoes to get the equivalent of 1 tomato back in the 40s. And so I was like, I remember reading about nutrient density a while back. Let me just go poke around this ANDI scale and see what it says about nutrient density. As some might be able to guess, all the things that have 1,000 are leafy greens. And we'll post a link to this in our show notes, of course, so people can look at it. And it's like, you know, the top one is kale, then collard greens, mustard greens, watercress, Swiss chard, bok choy, spinach, arugula, romaine, Brussels sprouts, carrot, cabbage, broccoli, you know, and that's already bringing you down. You know, kale is 1,000, broccoli's down there at 340, and you keep going down, 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 down. And the first time you see anything that is an animal-based food is shrimp, which has a score of 36 out of 1,000, right? And there are plant-based foods that are below that. Brown rice, almonds, etc. But all the animal-based foods are super low in terms of nutrient density. So I think that can be something people can use to debunk it, but it's obviously just a pretty silly argument in my eyes.
I think people will be horrified to see that white bread and corn chips are almost at the bottom.
Not my precious cola with a score of 1. I guess it gets 1 just because it has calories. I don't know.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if there's anything. It's like, I guess, I wonder where water falls. Is water food, Paul?
Is water food? That's a good question.
That'll be a show topic for another episode.
I was getting distracted because avocados and brown rice are both very low as well, which is a bummer.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if because it's basically on a per calorie basis, I'm assuming that because kale doesn't have a lot of calories, but it has a lot of nutrition, that's why it's up there.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the formula. And avocado probably has a lot more calories and fat, and even though it might have some nutrition in it and, you know, some good stuff for us, but because it comes with all the calories and fat, it's not as high up.
Yeah. No, but I don't know. But you know what I was just thinking, though, to bring it back to the main article, like, I feel like an easy counter to this would be the fact that, I mean, based on people that I know, vegans that I know, it's like, yeah, some people have trouble when they first go vegan, kind of like figuring out what their substitutes are going to be, figuring out what they cannot, what they're no longer going to eat and how to replace that. So yeah, it takes some time to figure things out, but you know, unless you're eating potato chips and drinking that precious Andy score of one cola, like you're like, I don't know a lot of malnourished vegans. And I'm not saying they're not out there, but I think there's so much proof, just anecdotal proof of the existence of vegans to prove that, you know, it's the diet itself, depending on how you do it. It's like, yeah, you could be malnourished, but you could be malnourished on a carnivore diet too. So it's just kind of like how you do it. And I don't know, it just seems like an easy kind of argument to poke holes in.
Yeah, it just it feels like someone, like if you take a step back, it just feels like someone that's really desperately trying to keep their industry afloat.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, so let's put that one to bed. Paul.
Good night.
We have talked extensively on the show about celebrities in veganism and the place that they have or don't have in promoting veganism or plant-based eating. In fact, we have a two-parter, episode 47 and 48, Are Celebrities Good for Veganism? And so you found something that is kind of an interesting follow-up to that. And, you know, we posed a lot of hypotheticals in that episode. There wasn't necessarily any hard evidence for celebrities positively influencing veganism or not, but what you got for us?
Yeah, I think that is to my knowledge, is the only episode that went on in the recording so long that we had to make it into a double-parter, which if you asked me, like, hey, Paul, out of any topic that you could talk about, which is the topic you think you would talk about the longest, celebrity vegans would not have been that topic. But yeah, I don't know. So this article, also from vegnews.com, research links Beyonce to rise in veganism. And just going to throw this out there. There's a lot of names that are difficult to pronounce in this one, so
I can't wait to hear you try, Paul.
Gonna do my best. In her doctoral thesis, University of Vasa PhD student Outi Lundahl argued that celebrity couple Beyoncé Knowles and Sean Corey Carter, professionally known as Jay-Z, had a lasting effect on the global interest in veganism after they adopted a plant-based diet for 22 days. While Lundahl initially began her thesis research by examining the rise of sustainable consumption in the United Kingdom, the PhD student stumbled on an interesting trend when she turned her attention to veganism. In December of 2013, pop diva Beyoncé, along with her husband, rapper Jay-Z, decided to go vegan for 22 days, Lundahl said. Interest in veganism seemed to explode because of this stint, and I became intrigued. Lundahl found that the couple swayed the public to conflate veganism with weight loss rather than environmental concern or animal rights. If the meanings and motivations for being a vegan change so that the diet is adopted merely to lose a couple of kilos after Christmas, or if it is followed due to celebrity emulation, Lundahl concluded, it is likely that the diet is soon forgotten. Lundahl suggested that governments promote aspects of veganism that are not merely diet related and found that the Finnish community of Sip Sikala Veganit has been focusing on posting caloric vegan recipes online. I must applaud efforts to make veganism seem tasty, fun, and easy, Lundahl said. In this way, veganism will hopefully lose its image as something extreme and strict.
Paul, let me first say I'm a little saddened that you wrote out the phonetic pronunciation of that town.
Well, who knows if that's...
hoping to hear you struggle through it and get some glorious bloopers out of it.
Sip Sikala Veganit. It's like 27 letters.
I like that the end of the name is vegan it.
Yeah, seriously. And I looked up a YouTube video of it to try and kind of figure it out, but it was not in English. So I was like, all right, when is this person going to say the word? And then I was like, okay, I think that was it. So I'm just going to go with that one. But first of all, about this article. So Andy, I pose this thought to you because I'm a little bit confused. I looked into the, because on this Veg News article, you can read the actual doctoral thesis. I looked at it a little bit, but I'm a little bit confused. And listeners, you might have heard this in the fact that the title of the article is called Research Links Beyonce to Rise in Veganism. The beginning kind of says how when Beyonce and Jay-Z went vegan, people like it, the interest in veganism seemed to rise. But then there's this one line towards the end where it says it is likely that if people just adopt veganism to lose some weight or because of celebrity, it's likely that they're going to go back to not being vegan. So that seems to indicate that they wouldn't, this isn't a good idea. And that it kind of goes along with what I think was our conclusion. One of our conclusions, one of our thoughts, at least of when we talked about this, and that's if people go vegan solely because of a celebrity, they're most likely not going to stick with it, or they're likely to not stick with it. And when I skimmed over the doctoral thesis, it did, like, there was a whole section about like why celebrities are important for veganism. So the author was still kind of promoting it, but it seems like there's this kind of conflict of, well, yeah, it's going to get more people interested in it, but are people going to stay? Maybe not.
Yeah, it's almost hard to have this conversation without totally retreading the entire two-parter of last time, but this
all right,
is,
let's get started.
This is it's kind of an interesting kind of, I don't know, paradox or like conflict of interest, but the author seems to imply that by associating it with diet, it makes it less extreme. I think playing off the societal norm that, hey, it's good to lose weight, everyone wants to lose weight, so if all veganism is going on a diet, then people like understand it better. Like they understand those motivations, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that have gone on a diet or wanted to go on a diet or have been on many diets. But then ultimately, yeah, that conclusion of like, well, it's more likely to be forgotten. It's like, yeah, how many fad trend diets out there? South Beach diet, Atkins diet, paleo, your time is coming, I'm sure. And yeah, I don't know. It just, like, I think it's better than not that there are vegan celebrities out there. I think it's cool when you can see a movie and be like, oh, by the way, that person was vegan. You know, Joaquin Phoenix holding it down, right?
But Quinoa Phoenix.
Quinoa Phoenix. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it really just depends on the celebrity and how they present veganism. And if it is a thing where they're like, trying this vegan thing, and then like 2 weeks later they're like, it was too hard, and they go back to eating animals and posting about it.
Yeah.
So it kind of reminds me of that time not too long ago when Kylie Jenner posted that they were like giving this vegan thing a try, and they posted a picture, maybe even Snapchatted a picture of some vegan tacos. And like from looking at it, like any reasonable person could go, it just sounds like she's saying, I'm eating some vegan tacos right now, and I've never tried purposely vegan food, and I'm going to see how it tastes. But a bunch of vegan blogs and people reposted it saying, Kylie Jenner is going vegan now. And sort of the argument being like, with that single post, she has saved more animals than even the most dedicated of animal rights activists, more than Ingrid Newkirk has ever saved or influenced, And people kind of use that to sort of downplay those that are a little more hesitant to promote celebrities that are kind of tentatively vegan or just sort of surface level vegan or just giving it a try. And I absolutely think we need to encourage all of those people. Like, I don't think that it helps anybody to be like, they're not really vegan or they're going to be wearing fur in 2 weeks and all that stuff. But I also think, you know, it's smart to not pounce on things because it can have a negative effect. You know, people seem to argue, all they'll remember is when they went vegan, not when they stopped being vegan. But I don't feel like that's true.
Yeah.
It just seems like wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things that could potentially influence people to go vegan or stay away from veganism, personal appearances, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that brings us to our topic of the week, which is, does having tattoos make you a bad animal rights advocate? And I feel like we've talked a lot about like body shaming, but in terms of like weight mostly. And this is sort of a different angle on that, and one that I think we should talk about, Paul.
I think so too.
Yeah, so we're going to do that as scheduled. So came across this article. It was posted on Medium.com by Lauren Marina, and it is titled, "Today I was told I am not an effective animal advocate because of my tattoos." So Lauren was at a animal rights conference in Luxembourg with about 80 other advocates, and an activist was on stage sort of presenting to the crowd about being an activist, and the presenter said, "I know some of you are not going to agree with this next slide," and then shows a slide with a photo of three people that have piercings, colored hair, or tattoos. And the article goes on to say, "We were told by the speaker that as activists and advocates for animals, we should consider the way we present our bodies to the public. That the personal choices illustrated on the slide, the tattoos, the piercings, the mohawks, can put people off from the movement and will make you less able to make connections and have conversations with the public, and moreover, will make you a less effective voice for animals." She, being the speaker, urged that these, quote, "radical body choices adopted by many in the movement make veganism less accessible to the mainstream." And further, she expressed that vegans who have a non-normie style cannot look professional enough to present our factual pleas for animals and be taken seriously. "My heart began to pound, my hands shaking. I felt personally attacked. I felt that my friends were attacked. I felt that our movement was being attacked." So, you know, Lauren goes on to talk about all of the activism that they've done and talks about how the reason that they got into veganism was because of like the DIY punk and hardcore scene, and how it's super common for a lot of people in that scene to have a lot of tattoos, and it's kind of like hand in hand. And it's like, would I even be at this conference if it wasn't for punk and hardcore? But I wouldn't have the tattoos if it wasn't for punk and hardcore as well. So I think this is an interesting topic because it's something that we choose to decorate our bodies with. And I guess we'll focus specifically on tattoos and not so much the piercings and the hair color, but all kind of can get lumped into the same thing, I suppose, although hair is easier to change. And this is something that I see a lot in the movement, in handbooks about how to be a good activist and books about social theory. And essentially it says, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, you're willing to die for animal rights, but are you willing to cut your dreads off for animal rights? And I guess, you know, as white people, you should just cut those dreads off anyway. But, you know, it's this idea that, like, are you willing to put on a suit for the movement? Like, are you willing to sort of get rid of your, you know, social capital, your cultural capital, your signifiers for your group of people, you know, in this case, not getting tattoos or covering up your tattoos or not wearing your band shirts, I guess, the things that sort of help you identify your crew. Are you willing to shed those to look more quote unquote normal in order to have more influence over more people? So, Paul, I'm wondering, what do you think about this experience? And we're not going to talk about this specific speaker. We don't know who this specific speaker was. And even if we did, I think it's kind of beside the point because this is such a prevalent notion in the movement that, like, hey, you want to be effective for animals, you sort of have to, you want to make sure you look a certain way or you blend in with normal, quote unquote, normal society as much as possible. Paul, what are your first impressions upon hearing about Lauren's experience and like, how do you feel about this in general?
So my first impression, if everyone who became vegan then also converted like their appearance and how they looked, and what I believe that is tied to is like for many people part of their identity, whether it be like a member of the punk and hardcore scene or any other kind of strong identity they have like that, if they lose that identity or they lose their some of their ties with that identity, I think that is hurting the movement in that they will then when they go to talk to the people who they know the best, which is going to be the people in that movement, the punk and hardcore movement per se, like if these people that aren't vegan that are into punk and hardcore see these other people that are like, wait, so you went vegan and now you look completely different and you changed completely. I feel like that would be very unattractive to other members of that group. So I think by kind of changing your style and your identity. Something that you say all the time, Andy, it's like, when we go vegan, we don't need to lose the other parts of ourselves. By not losing the other parts of ourselves, I think we can be more effective advocates to the members of the communities that we know the best anyways. So, and then I guess, though, to play devil's advocate on the other side, like, you, as we've also said, you're not as good of an advocate to members of communities who you are not a part of, that you're not a part of. But I mean, that's going to always be the case. You can't be, you know, you can't be a part of every single community, which doesn't mean that, like in this case, someone with tattoos, it doesn't mean that they can't go over and talk to someone that doesn't have tattoos. Like, I'm the whoever that person was, they might be right that they might not be able to be as effective of an advocate to that one specific person that maybe doesn't have tattoos or judges tattoos like a real jerk. But like, it doesn't mean that they're gonna fail completely. I think that the value that's gained in diversifying the movement, having people from all these different communities, then being able to go back to their own community and advocate for veganism, I think that the value that's gained in that vastly overweighs the value that would be gained by creating this homogenous vegan movement where everyone looks and dresses the same. I think that would be very unappealing to a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess I wonder, when people sort of bring up this point of view that we have to look as much like normal society as possible, it makes me feel like we're kind of prizing the inclusion of certain people within the movement over others. And it's like, why is it that we want the straight-laced businessman in this movement more than we want the punk kid? I understand there could be an argument like, oh, well, people wearing suits are the ones that are more likely to be making government policies. We want those people on board. They're the ones that have probably more money to donate to the causes. But it's like, why do we need the punk kid that got into veganism to transform themselves to be the one that advocates for that person? I think that there's a lot to be said about authenticity. And, you know, when I'm talking with people, when I was like doing outreach, you know, I feel like the people I connected with the most are when you sort of just got real with them, or you joke around with them, you swear a little bit, like you show you're not just some like tight laced, like polo shirt wearing guy that's there to try and like change their mind. It's like, hey, like I'm a cool dude. I can hang with the kids, with the youth. Right. And people can see authenticity. And you know, when I would be touring around and having conversations with people, I honestly felt my authenticity waning the longer I went on a tour and the more my conversations kind of went on autopilot. I could tell that I was less effective because I wasn't having a spontaneous conversation. And obviously, as vegans, we answer the same questions a billion times, and sometimes it's hard to make it feel fresh and new and spontaneous. But I think that I could see people like me not getting people as much when I was sort of on autopilot, and they could tell that I wasn't being authentic with them. So like, I'm thinking about the punk kid that's like, I want to lobby, or like they're being told the best way to advocate for animals is to go lobby, you know, this, you know, congressman or whatever it might be, and they have to dress up. But I feel like the people that are trying to influence, they see through that. Like, they see that it's not an authentic one of their own, so to speak. They're not a credible messenger for them. So I think that they probably won't take it as seriously. And I guess this kind of goes to what we were talking about last episode with Carol Adams, Paul, that was like, you know, leave the feminist conversations to the feminists to have amongst each other. Why do you need some angry man coming in and being like, you're not feminist if you don't do this? And it's like, why don't you go talk to the other white men out there? And yeah, it just feels like when we're saying we need to look a certain way, it almost, to me, it almost feels like coded language for we need to cater to and prioritize white men more than anybody else that we're talking to, and to some degree white women as well. And it just makes me wonder, like, why do we need to cater to these people? It's not like people that have tattoos are a significant minority within the population.
Yeah.
Not everyone has it. I know we were looking up numbers on that, and it's not 50% of the population or anything, but it's damn close.
And I mean, I think this is not to say that you can't kind of think about if you're going into some specific situation. Like, it's not to say you can't think about how you can most effectively portray yourself in different situations. Like, I think if you were going to, you know, make a speech in front of the UN or something like that about the environmental issues and why we need to adopt a vegan diet, it's like, yeah, you'd probably want to dress nicely, because you know that those people are probably going to take you more seriously if you dress nicely. But I think that's different than, like, you know, giving up a piece of yourself. I don't think wearing a suit on occasion is like foregoing all of your punk roots.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, and Andy, like, at the animal rights conference, which we just went to, which was not the largest event, vegan event that we've been to, but there was a substantial amount of people. Like, at the plenary dinner, the special guest was Kat Von D, who is, you know, heavily tattooed from basically from head to toe.
And is a tattoo artist.
And yeah, that's true. And so it's like, you know, it's not as if there aren't prominent vegans, especially celebrities that have tattoos.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we've been talking all about these negatives of having tattoos, or perceived negatives. And I don't want to lie and say that there aren't people that have negative views of people with tattoos, that there's not a stigma attached for some people. But I think we could also look at the opposite side of that coin and say, well, what about all the people that think tattoos are cool? What about all the celebrities that do have tattoos that are heavily tattooed? Your Kat Von D or your Steve-O, or I don't know, Moby probably has some tattoos. Like, you know, it's just like one of those things where it's like, I bet there's a lot of people that look up to people with tattoos. And if they didn't, they would probably view them as less cool. Like, tattoos are really cool to a lot of people. And I guess to the point, it's like, not every single person is going to be able to influence or inspire every person on the planet. Everyone is going to have a little chunk of the planet that they could help influence. And we need a representation of everyone in order to achieve that.
Andy, before when you were talking about, like, oh, I got to look cool in front of these kids, I just imagine you out at a college campus with the backwards hat, sunglasses, and a fidget spinner in each hand. Just like, who wants to talk about veganism?
Hello, fellow students. Was that Steve Buscemi meme? Hello, fellow teenagers or whatever.
Yeah, with the skateboard.
Yeah, that is absolutely me. You should. I mean, it was like when, you know, I'd be on a college campus and someone would try and talk about the local sports team. And I am just like, I can't even fake it. I can't even pretend that I could, like, pass my way through that conversation. Like, it's just like a super awkward thing. And like, it's funny actually, because our boss at the time was like, we could give you budget to, whenever you get to a new campus, go to the student center, student union, and buy a hat from the school of the local sports team, because that will endear you to the students. But I'm like, yeah, but when they're like, how about the game last night? And I'm just like, yeah, they really scored all the points. You know, it's just like, they know that's not authentic, so I'm not going to try and pretend to be something that I'm not. And especially if they catch me kind of lying about who I am, that's probably going to paint everything I've said to them in a negative light. They're going to question everything that I've said.
Yeah. There's another podcast I was listening to, and someone asked the question, how do you look older? And when the person's like, how do you look older? You try to look younger.
Perfect.
But, yeah, so we've derailed the conversation. Sorry, Andy, with fidget spinners. But, yeah, I think there's so much, there's more value in expressing, you know, like, who you are and expressing the community that you represent the most, or the identity that you represent the most, and being an advocate to those, to that group of people. I think there's so much value in that, and it overshadows any of, like, the negative stigma that comes with having tattoos or piercings or, like, different colored hair.
Yeah, definitely. And so I mentioned that we did a little research into some of the numbers, so I wanted to just bring those up to give people an idea. I would guess that literally every single person listening knows someone with a tattoo, and a good chunk of the people listening, just by the statistics, probably have tattoos themselves. Mm-hmm. Trying to find the exact number of people, like adults with tattoos in the U.S., There was no like very solid numbers, but they generally ranged between 25 and 40%. So at the very least, one out of every four adults has a tattoo. Could be almost, you know, one out of every three, or a little higher than that even. And then according to a Pew poll, of those 25 to 40% of adults that do have tattoos, at least 69% of them have at least two tattoos, two or more. So obviously not all of those people are like head to toe, neck tats, hand tats, all that stuff. But it's a pretty common thing. And again, not saying there's no stigma against tattoos at all, but it's like, okay, people with tattoos, they can appeal to that 25 to 40% of the population. That's a pretty good chunk of the population. That's way more than the percentage of the population that's vegan right now.
Yeah.
So why not appeal to those people? Like, why say everyone needs to look a certain way and wear a suit, and all of a sudden you're like, that 40% of the population doesn't matter to us?
Mm-hmm. And just from an anecdotal example, I know when I taught in a high school, more of the teachers had tattoos than did not have tattoos. And like you said, not all of them were huge, but there were some like pretty big, pretty visible ones. So, you know, I think it's the times are a changing, Andy.
Yeah, they certainly are. You want to talk about this Huffington Post article you found?
Yeah, so in our kind of research on the tattoo stigma, I guess, I found a Huffington Post article. Love this title, Tattoos in the Workplace, the research Forbes was too lazy to do. So basically, they kind of talked about how if you Google, like, are tattoos acceptable in the workplace, a lot of the articles you'll see coming out were using sort of outdated research, or just they were all using the same kind of three sources from some years back. So the Huffington Post found a few other sources just to talk about, like, a more current perception of tattoos. So they found that 86% of young professionals did not think piercings or tattoos reduced the chance of getting jobs. They found that grooming and business attire were more important indicators of the hiring decision than tattoos and piercings, and that heavily tattooed professionals felt that tattoos made them more accessible to younger coworkers, which is kind of what we were saying before. Got to be cool to the young people. Get some more tattoos.
Yeah, and actually, Paul, that's kind of a really interesting point. Because, you know, I don't think that we need to cast aside trying to convince people, you know, 30 and above to go vegan or anything. But there's like, there's more lives saved when the younger a person is when they go vegan, the less animals they will consume over their lifetime. So it's almost like if the trend is, and every resource I looked at said the amount of people with tattoos is going up all the time. So if the trend is that younger people are getting more and more tattoos, then wouldn't it actually be a really positive thing for people to have tattoos? Because that's the younger generation. That's the people that we want to go vegan more than anyone.
Yeah, no, that I think that's true. I don't know if your assessment that getting a younger person to go vegan will save more animals than getting an older person to go vegan. I don't know about that, but
how could that not be a correct assessment, Paul?
Because my point is, it would save, I think it would save the exact same amount of animals, right? Like
their lifetime.
But I don't know. There's always people. There's people being born like every, you know, 3 seconds or whatever. So as soon as one of the people dies, there's going to be another baby to replace them. It's like, I think every single person, when they go vegan, like they've been taken out of the equation of people buying animals. And I don't think it matters what their lifespan is, because like that single person has been taken out of the equation.
Well, I'm not saying that like the percentage of people, I get what you're saying. Like, basically what you're saying, Paul, is the percentage of people will remain the same regardless of if they're old or young. But if someone over the course of their lifetime, and this is just number totally pulled out of nowhere, say someone over their lifetime was to consume 1,000 animals. It's way more than that, obviously. Now, someone that has lived 10% of their life and then goes vegan, that means they will only have killed 100 animals in their lifetime. But as someone who is 70 years old and goes vegan, that means that they will have killed 700 animals in their lifetime.
But you're talking about it like measuring the past and the future, but we're in the present. Andy, get in the present, Andy. We're in the present right now. And at this exact moment, if I got a 10-year-old to go vegan or if I got a 50-year-old to go vegan, at this exact moment, the same from this point on, the same amount of animals would be saved.
Yeah, but the older person will die sooner, and that's like you're getting more. You're getting, generally speaking, statistically speaking, you get more bang for your buck when a younger person goes vegan.
I'm gonna think about this, re-listen to this discussion we just had, and edit it out if I'm incorrect.
I think the math checks out, Paul. And as a fan of math, I think you should be into this analysis. Right. And again, not saying that this means abandoning outreach to anyone over the age of like 25 or anything. I think that's totally ridiculous. I think anyone any age can go vegan and should go vegan. And I think people should advocate to people generally within their age range.
I totally agree with that. I also, from that Huffington Post article, I did also want to bring up that there was research found that tattoos might still be limiting to the workplace in some regards, and that one of the big exceptions was visibly tattoos had a predominantly negative effect on employment selection driven by the hiring manager's perception of customer expectations. So it's like if you're going to be put in a position where you're highly visible to the consumer, to the customer, if you're going to be on the front line, then it did say that the hiring team is maybe a little bit less likely to hire you. So there is still that. But again, I think that they are becoming, like, they're only becoming more acceptable. I don't foresee, except for some weird event that happens, I don't foresee this turning around and us becoming a society where it's like all of a sudden tattoos are no longer acceptable.
Paul, let me ask you a question.
Paint me a picture, Andy.
What is your hypothetical weird event that happens that could make this trend reverse?
If, like, we elect an Amish president or something like that, and tattoos are banned.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Or, like, an ultra-conservative president, which we are kind of in that position right now.
Yeah.
But...
But even no, then, I feel like the pub. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. I don't think that you could.
Never
possibly...
heard that expression before.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think no matter how, like, unless it was some authoritarian regime, but it feels like even then tattoos would be the least of their worries.
Yeah.
So anyway, all of that is to say, tattoo acceptance is only growing.
Yeah.
By the year, and. Everything we said just sort of points to the fact that, like, it may be beneficial to have tattoos. Not saying go out and get tattoos to appeal to young people, but just saying, like, if you do have them, if that's your thing, you know, be confident in the fact that you can be a fantastic advocate. You could potentially be a much more effective advocate than the suit-wearing normie guy.
Yeah. I think that's an important point you made, Andy. All this is to say... Don't go out and get a tattoo solely because you want to look cooler to younger kids. Well, I guess do whatever you want to do. I'm not gonna judge you.
Yeah, do whatever you want. Just make sure it's a vegan tattoo.
Yeah. The tattoo toothpaste is out of the tube.
Tattoo toothpaste. That should nice. Be a thing, right?
It should be.
Yeah, that's what you want to do with a fresh tattoo, right? Is scrub it with a bristly brush. The harder the bristle, the better.
Yeah. So do we have anything else about this
I think
tattoo
that's
conundrum?
It. I think I feel like, Paul, I feel like we can definitively say you can be an amazing advocate if you have tattoos.
But Andy, can we put the tattoo toothpaste cap back on the tattoo toothpaste?
Is you can. It'll over? Just be an empty tube.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, all the tattoos are spilled out all over the place.
All right. We're it's too hot at both of our locations, and we're slowly being driven to madness by this heat.
Of course, we want to know what all you wonderful beardos have to say about this. What has your experience been as a tattooed animal rights activist? Have you been hesitant to get a tattoo because you're worried about your perception and your effectiveness? Tell us your stories. Send those in to thebeardvegans@gmail.com. Send in your questions and comments to thebeardvegans@gmail.com for our upcoming mailbag episode. Get those iTunes reviews in. And yeah, 5 stars. Hey, we love those.
If you're going to send in mailbag episode questions, just make sure to telepathically know that we just said that, because if you send them in after you hear this, it's too late.
The mailbag is always open, Paul.
That's true. I guess. Just know that if you send it in after next Wednesday, we will have most likely already recorded that episode.
Such a buzzkill, Paul.
Sorry, Andy. I'm sorry. I just didn't want to get people's hopes up. They got to wait 10 weeks till their question is answered.
Yeah, that's a lot of months.
Three, to be exact.
All right. All right, math professor Paul.
I'm going to go back and think about that discussion that we had before about the converting younger people versus older people. But anyways, Andy, what do you got coming up?
All right. Well, when people hear this, I will be driving furiously but responsibly from Chicago to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania for the September 30th Phoenixville Veg Fest. And then October 1st, the next day, I will be at the Vegan Food and Drink Fest in Randall's Island in New York City. October 7th and 8th, I will be at the New Jersey Veg Fest at the Meadowlands in Secaucus, New Jersey. And don't forget the 8th, I will be speaking on a panel with Ginny Messina and JL Fields at 10:15 a.m., I think, bright and early. So make sure to head out for that, talking about the old body positivity and fat shaming and disease shaming, all that not-so-good stuff. Yeah. That's all I'm going to announce for now. There's plenty more dates, deeds, and links for those and other events all the way through December at CompassionCo.com. And, of course, at all those events, you can find me behind the Compassion Company table.
Right on, Andy.
Yeah. Paul.
Yes, Andy.
You know, sometimes people will refer to, like, face tattoos and hand tattoos as job stoppers.
Yeah.
But in my research, I learned there's actually one thing you could get tattooed right on your forehead that would be guaranteed to get you hired on the spot.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, it's actually just, it's an old English font. You have to use that specific font. Don't you go using Comic Sans or Wingdings, God forbid. Old English font, and all it has to say is the following 7 words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off. What's up, beardos? Welcome to episode...
But definitely delicious... Yeah, well, I guess maybe not.
Great lead-in.
So, the news, eh? What's the deal? There wasn't really any super solid numbers, but they generally raged between... Raged... They generally raged against the machine. People should advocate to people generally within their age range. Motorcycle. Motorcycle. Car. And, you know, it's just kind of like, whatever. October. Is it car? This fucking truck convention over here. I feel like everyone with pickup trucks is like, you're doing a podcast. there must be some sort of pickup truck convention. I'm like behind a building and no one has driven back here for the entirety of the recording. And now everyone's just driving by and like revving their engine. Where are these people coming from? This guy's driving real slow. Oh my God, here come the motorcycles again. What is going on?
Oh my God.
What is this? Where are they coming from?